Hey everybody, how you doing? Welcome back to Past Gas. This week we are talking about a NASCAR legend of the car variety. We're talking about the Hudson Hornet, one of the first factory sponsored race teams out there. The Hudson Corporation, really interesting story behind them. Also, Marshall Teague and a guy named Herb Thomas, one of the greatest drivers of all time, who was a tobacco farmer, had very humble beginnings, became an amazing driver. You like Doc Hudson from Cars? You're going to love this episode. Bart is here.
If you're five, you're going to love this episode.
If you're 95, you're going to love this episode.
All right.
But none of the ages in between.
Let's get into it. February 11th, 1951. 10,000 spectators have lined the sands of the Daytona Beach and road course to cheer on 54 young men vying to win the opening race of NASCAR's third season. Several future legends of the sport are pushing their stock cars to the limit that day, including Buck Baker, Lee Petty, Fireball Roberts, and brothers Tim and Fonty Flock. However, as the checkered flag draws near, all eyes fall on Daytona local Marshall Teague in a brand new 1951 Hudson Hornet. Sitting low thanks to Hudson's innovative step-down design, its high-compression 308 cubic inch inline six rumbles across the beach, carrying Teague to a first-place finish. The win marks Teague's and Hudson's first NASCAR victories. But another driver, a tobacco farmer who wheels his Plymouth to 16th that day, would soon become the face of Hudson's dominant racing era, and decades after a career-ending crash, would inspire the voice of a generation in one of Hollywood's largest animated movie franchises. For Hudson, the win at Daytona couldn't have come at a better time. Facing dwindling sales in the early 1950s, Hudson executives found an opportunity in NASCAR: marketing. But to ensure the wins kept coming, Hudson didn't stop at supplying cars and cash. At the automaker's Detroit headquarters, engineers and drivers began collaborating on rule-bending engines, suspension, and other special parts that would give the Hornet an edge on the oval, and ideally a boost in the showroom. With Hudson becoming the first factory NASCAR team, their efforts birthed the slogan, "Win on Sunday, sell on Monday." But would commanding success on the track actually improve sales? Today on Past Gas, how did a farmer become NASCAR's first two-time champ? What made the Hornet nearly unbeatable? And why didn't back-to-back-to-back championships save Hudson from the chopping block? This is the story of NASCAR's unlikely superstars of the 1950s, Herb Thomas and the fabulous Hudson Hornet. That is what a Hudson or a Hornet sounds like.
Yeah.
Hornet is a wasp, correct?
Different. They're different.
They're different.
Yeah. Wasps are malicious.
I hate wasps.
Wasps are one of the only animals where, like an insect, that they're like, yeah, they have, you can kill them.
Yeah.
We don't need
them. There's actually like a subset of Instagram and TikTok videos of people, because they like hover. Hmm. They attack bees. They attack hives. And people will come in with scissors and just like cut them in half. And they'll show it in slow motion or whatever. But they like eat bees. They rip the heads off of bees and like mess stuff up.
So a wasp, general term.
Yeah.
For lots of insects, including hornets.
White Aryan. what is it?
White Anglo-Saxon.
Okay.
Not white Aryan. So
yeah, that's redundant.
Wasps construct paper and mud nests, while hornets, they just like their paper nests. This is all from thespruce.com. Make your best home. Anyway, wasp is a hornet is a type of wasp.
Okay.
Anyway, we got that out of the way.
Yeah.
We got
wasp
our
is a general term for shitty bees.
What is the term
bees?
That's our entomology segment of the show. Welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Sitting across from me today is the one and only Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me back, guys.
Thanks for your wasp knowledge. And, of course, we got Joe G. Weber.
Buzz, buzz, bitch.
guys, have you guys seen a little movie called Cars?
Yeah. I've got many of them in my house.
Yeah?
Any copies? Yeah.
They're all
no, I mean many of the cars from this Mattel subset of Disney's Cars.
Do you have movies? Doc?
I have Doc, we have the Hudson Hornet. I guess you'd call it livery doc.
Nice. Oh yeah, when
there's lots of iterations of there have been three movies and mm-hmm. everybody they're quick to give you all the different paint jobs on the same body of car.
Say that. Oh yeah.
Additionally, Cars 2 has guns. I was halfway through it and I was like, there's a lot of guns in this.
Strange choice.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole like conspiracy thing.
Yeah, there's spies and stuff. Yeah. So
there's also sidewalks in the Cars universe, which would mm-hmm. presume that humans exist. Mm-hmm. Where are the humans?
Yeah. Or they did it one time and they kept the sidewalks as a
kind
of a reminder.
Tradition.
Oh. Yeah. It's their memorial to humans for building them.
Strange choice. There's definitely got to be like a video essay out there on YouTube. It's like, Cars 2, the underrated espionage thriller of the 21st century.
No, there's entire deep dives because there's also planes.
Uh-huh.
And there's allusions to, say, World War II.
Yeah.
And there's deep dives into the fact that there must have then been a car Hitler.
Well, there's also... TSA agents in number two because they fly to Europe, which would presume that there was a 9/11. Where planes
I wonder
were
if
the buildings
cars
alive?
Have to, like,
I don't know.
Do they have to take their wheels off? They're like, actually, no, keep your wheels on.
Yeah, if you're pre-check.
We have an updated policy.
If you're pre-check, you keep your wheels on. Yeah. Yeah. But you still have to turn your OBD2 off.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going through.
No, I don't want to go through the micro scanner. Yeah. You can stick your finger up my tailpipe.
It's all in there.
All the money, guys. So yeah, I am looking forward
have you
to
been having start. TSA agents finger your butthole, Joe?
Doesn't everyone?
No,
doesn't everyone
it's
wave
not
the micro scanner to get fingers up their butthole? Oh, before we get into it, we have a rodent snack segment.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Bart, would you do the honors? No,
nothing.
The bottom.
Okay. There's nothing. Oh,
there's a pack of candy.
Ciggies.
We got to take those out.
That's the winner.
Ah.
Will you show the camera?
An Abba Zabba.
Abba Zabba.
You're my only friend.
All right.
Remember?
You want to speak to it?
I just felt like this is like a very 50s candy for a very 50s story.
Fair enough. Okay.
I found out about Abba Zabba by... I think everyone my age half baked.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I remember.
I'm a little worried it's going to rip my crowns out.
Yeah, there was a candy store in Atascadero that I used to go to in junior high with my friends. Every Thursday, we'd go up to Sweet Memories up on Traffic Way, and they sold like older vintage candies like this one. Mm-hmm. Is this peanut butter?
This is very, and the great thing about this. It's just realizing how far we've come with candy technology, right? Yeah. I mean, it really is. Think about if this was all that you had. Mm-hmm. You're like, I understand why one might choose this once a year mm-hmm. over, say, a Snicker with its nougat, caramel, chocolate, and nuts. Mm. But come on. It's pretty one note.
So
but it's good.
Anyone?
It is good. It's a good peanut butter in there.
Anyone in the dark about this? It's
It's called Abba Zabba.
Abba Zabba. Chewy taffy with a peanut butter center. It does taste like old-timey candy. It's pretty good, though.
It is good.
I would eat more.
I like it.
Just for the listener's sake, I'm not going to eat any more, though.
But it's like one. It's maybe not even an entire Abba Zabba per road trip. That's what I think.
I would not eat this whole thing.
I can't imagine
eating
this
whole
thing.
Bar.
Mm-mm. I'm still chewing.
It's like if you left fluff out for a week. And put peanut butter on it. And you're like, ugh, this does taste good. And I'm not going to waste my Fluffer peanut butter. But, ugh. You know, you're just trying to, you know, you don't want to waste stuff, you know.
You guys ever watch? Sorry, I'm still chewing here. It's hard to talk. Let me finish this.
This is going to be a great episode.
Right, let's talk about.
Just eat this. All
time. Snackability. I'd say mid.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's enjoyable, and I think it's, like, you don't go on a road trip all the time, so if this was your thing, road trip, I'll have a Abba Zabba.
This is what
like
you give when your kid doesn't shut up, and you're
that's
like,
oh, that's a good
chew
idea.
Chew on something
let's,
for
guys,
the next
let's
20
all
minutes.
Share an Abba Zabba.
Oh, Okay. Right? That's pretty clutch, actually. Yeah. That's a good tip.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now that I have a kid, I'm thinking about, like, how do I get this thing to shut up? How,
what can I give them that might kill them but let me off as an accident? Abba Zabba.
Like how Casey Anthony Googled how to get rid of a toddler body.
I did not know that. And I don't
she didn't get caught
that.
Because the police didn't know that Firefox was a thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead. Sorry. It's a fine candy bar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Road trip ability. I honestly think it's pretty strong. You get a lot of
bang for your buck.
Yeah. Bang for your buck in terms of mouth work. as a task, pretty good bang for your buck. Like, it's going to last you like probably 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah. If you ate the whole thing,
you ate the whole thing. Flavor's pretty decent.
It took you 5 minutes to eat one tiny chunk.
I mean, that might get you, you might get a couple hours on that. You might get.
Yeah. Cause you can spread it out.
You could probably get from Chicago to Louisville with one Abba Zabba.
Yeah. It's later. Mm-hmm. That thing is a day long task.
He's going to eat it. He's going to
start chomping away. No, I'm looking at the nutrition facts. Let's see.
It just says zero.
Oh, it's got one. I was going to say, dude, honestly, Abba Zabba, 1 gram of protein in here. I feel like they could jack that number up.
Yeah.
Start marketing to like protein bodybuilders Zabba. And stuff.
Yeah, it's post-workout.
Yes.
Paleo Zabba.
This is basically.
I think that's.
There's protein bars. There's protein bars that are as hard to eat as this. Mm-hmm. I think they should look into that.
What's your rodent snack rating?
I'm going to go like 5 out of 10. I don't know. It's just like.
I'd give it a 5 or 6. I think that's enjoyable. And I think for a road trip like that, if I'm ranking that as a, do you want this candy bar all the time? It's definitely no.
No.
But absolutely if you're on a road trip, yeah.
Why not?
What a special treat.
Yeah, once a year kind of thing.
They got to think about the packing too. I understand like the nostalgia play. This is probably how it looked in like the 60s, but like it looks like you're eating a taxi. You know, it's got black
road
and yellow.
Hey, I think that's a bonus.
Black and yellow checkerboard. It's strange. It's strange.
I mean, those are the donut colors.
Well, it's not like this.
You literally have a shirt that is exactly like that, but says donut. checkerboard. Ooh.
The font is close, though. All right.
Anyways, my rodent snack score is 5.
I wouldn't. I was going to look up if it's a if it's classic packaging.
Uh-oh.
It is not.
Uh-oh.
Packaging that you would use today.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's where Abba Zabba comes from.
I don't know.
It's a white guy's version of what a tribes member would say. Let's just say that.
What?
Doesn't age very well.
Retro packaging? Hold on.
What?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
All right, so Abba Zabba, I know that, you're getting a 0.
What?
There's no reason this needs to exist anymore.
Okay. Yeah, that's crazy, dude. You need to rebrand. Call it something else.
Oh, what no.
Holy
I'm reading. So there's a candy wrapper
that's
museum.
That's some racist shit, dude.
Yeah.
And he's writing, people have written to me asking whether Abba Zabba had ever featured racially biased graphics. I'd never heard of this. Then shortly thereafter, I was contacted by Air Force veteran, name redacted, who had the wrapper and was wondering about its authenticity. Throw it out.
Yeah.
Anyways.
No.
Maybe we'll omit the dark history of Abba Zabba.
That's crazy, dude. Wow.
From this episode.
Well, all right. Okay. Well, if I was them, I would probably rebrand. That's crazy. Okay. Wow. Learn something new every day here on Pass Gas.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Shall we get into our story this week? The Hudson Hornet.
Yeah. Let's into it.
Let's talk about our sources here real quick. We got Real NASCAR, White Lightning, Red Clay, and Big Bill France by Daniel S. Pierce. Cars of the Fabulous 50s by James Flamang. Chrome by Brian Laban. And The Fabulous Hudson Hornet directed by Tom Quigley. Have to check that out. So, there's your sources for this episode. Let's get into it. In February 1909, a group of Detroit businessmen led by Roy D. Chapin founded Hudson Motor Car Company. With the financial backing of department store magnate Joseph Hudson, the automaker set out to build affordable vehicles that would sell for under $1,000, close to $35,000 today. Their efforts came at a time when the automobile had only begun to reach the masses, with the $850 Model T, which is around $29,500 in today's money, debuting the year prior. At the same time, a new Cadillac could be driven out of the showroom for $1,795, about $62,000
today. It's weird how analogous that is to modern day cars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like a cheap car is $30,000.
Mm-hmm. The first production Hudson, a Model 20, left the factory on July 3rd of 1909, less than 4 months after the company's formation. 4 months.
That's crazy.
A newspaper ad for the new Roadster read, quote, Bart, you want to do a silly voice?
Here's a car that is good looking. It's big and racy. Note the graceful and harmonious lines. Observe the sweep of the fenders of frame. It's what I do. I just say what I look at and what it looks like.
By the end of 1909, workers assembled more than 4,500 examples, the best first-year production of any U.S. automaker to date.
Yeah, that is pretty good success out of the gate.
It's also at a time when there, you know, weren't a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just 4,500 cars in 1909.
That's a lot.
That's like 20% of the all cars that exist.
Under the leadership of Chapin, Hudson invested in a larger facility to accommodate their success. Throughout its growth, which included adding the Essex and Terraplane lines in 1919 and 1932 respectively, Hudson focused on technical advancement. Engineers at the company developed a number of firsts in the auto industry, including a dual braking setup that combined mechanical and hydraulic systems for added safety.
So it's like a hand lever and then your feet on the ground?
No. Oh, you drag your feet.
Yeah, dual braking?
Yeah. No, it's 2 feet. That's dual braking.
We can also thank Hudson for idiot lights, named for obvious reason, better known today as dash warning lights.
Did That's Hudson cool. call them idiot lights, though? He coined it.
Featuring idiot lights.
Observe the idiot lights.
They're illuminated, you dummy.
In the 1930s, Hudson replaced finicky gauges with illuminating bulbs to warn drivers of potential issues regarding both oil pressure and the generator, which is basically the alternator.
Yeah.
As with many smaller automakers of the era, the Great Depression followed by World War II stifled growth. But the war also presented an unexpected opportunity for young men and women across the world to learn the ins and outs of vehicle mechanics and how to drive them. For future NASCAR Hall of Famer Herb Thomas, this meant cutting his teeth behind the wheel of a logging rig on the busy roads of Fort Bragg.
I love the idea of somebody driving a logging truck around Fort Bragg and people like, slow down!
Yeah,
it's like a logging truck!
Drifting.
For many others, they developed skills that would push automobile performance into a new era. Whether they'd be wrenching in the studios of Detroit automakers, the backwoods of Moonshine Territory, or at the racetrack.
I like how the backwoods of moonshine territory is really just moonshine territory.
Yeah. Yeah. All the backwoods.
It's
are,
all,
yeah. Despite surviving the battles in Europe and Asia, Hudson faced an uncertain future. Hungry for post-war success, engineers resumed their innovative ways. Like most car builders, the first post-war Hudsons of 1946 were essentially 1942 examples, but they had something new coming down the pipe. Though it carried the Commodore name, first introduced in 1941, the automaker released an all-new radical body style for 1948, a model year ahead of the big three. Penned in part by Betty Thatcher, one of the industry's first female designers, the 1948 Hudsons featured a refined, slab-sided body that tucked away the bulbous fenders of the pre-war era and an almost fastback-style sloped roof. The most attention-grabbing aspect of the car wasn't its design, but its stance. The car sat exceptionally low compared to its rivals thanks to the new step-down frame that would become a key factor in Hudson's impending on-track success. The step-down design placed the floor within the perimeter of the frame as opposed to on top of it, a step towards the unibody construction of today. This resulted in a safer cabin, a lower center of gravity, and enhanced handling. Building on the success of the step-down design, Hudson soon expanded its lineup with something a little more stylish and a heck of a lot quicker.
So I'm trying to understand what this means. Is it?
So
if you think of the old, how high the older cars were.
Yeah, super high.
It's because right. The body, like the cab of the body sat on top of the frame rails.
Yeah.
Whereas this cab, it sounds like it's in between the frame rails. So it sits like probably.
Well, even if you think of the cars of, you know, then the 50s and 60s, when if you take the body off the frame, it's the frame's in here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you've got that extra lower center of gravity. The seats are lower. The car is lower.
So it's kind of like tubbed?
I guess. Comparatively, okay. You might call it tubbed. You do have wheel wells that I think would have been more pronounced starting lower.
Okay.
If I could also say, I believe the original phrase, while coming down the pipe and coming down the pike are both used today acceptably. Yeah. I believe the original phrase was coming down the pike.
The pike.
Yes. Which also applies more strictly to automobiles.
So. What's the pike?
Turnpike.
Okay.
Coming down the pike. And the turnpike actually gets its name because originally their toll booths would have a large wooden pike. They would turn the pike to let you through after you paid.
Oh, that makes sense.
Here we go. Here's some chassis designs. Let's see.
I think he meant what his phrasing meant was down the pipeline.
Mm.
Okay, so usually the floor is on top of the frame rails in the cab, but it looks like, so you have your frame rails going down the side of the body, and then your floor, I mean, I can start.
Flips over, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like the floor attaches down here rather than sitting on top here. So it's all sitting, that's probably like 8 inches or so of frame rail.
Yeah. That would be low for the time.
Yeah, exactly.
On October 16th, 1950, the Hudson Hornet made its official debut. Available as a coupe, sedan, or convertible, the rather sleek automobile came equipped with a high compression 5-liter 308 cubic inch straight six billed as the H145.
Let's go, dude.
The 145 representing its horsepower rating. Oh. Okay. Is that not so exciting?
I was like, yeah, dude.
Yeah, let's
high compression, 308.
5 liters, 145 horsepower. Yeah. This was a hefty number considering Lee Petty was racing a 97 horsepower Plymouth at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's pretty substantial.
Yeah, the Hudson.
50% increase.
Yeah, that would win races. The Hudson could be had with, what?
That could win races.
Yeah. Against something with 50% less horsepower. The Hudson could be had with a 3 on the tree,
nice.
With or without overdrive, or a GM hydromatic transmission. With ample torque and a low slung design, Hudson had unintentionally built a race car that would prove to be one to beat.
Nice.
The Hornet's introduction to the market couldn't have come at a better time for the brand or NASCAR. In its third year, NASCAR founder Bill France tightened the rules around his version of stock car racing. In short, by 1951, stock meant stock. The rule change made it more expensive for many racers to acquire a competitive car, which led to drivers pulling all sorts of tricks to get their hands on a fresh set of wheels. This included Marshall Teague, who had to borrow a Hudson for the 1951 strictly stock Daytona race from a local dealer on the promise he would return it in new shape.
In like new shape.
In like new shape.
Like new.
Give or take a few miles on the clock.
Yeah, see, like new. Very nebulous. It's hard to perfectly define what that means.
Like it's like new.
Yeah, it's like new.
Like it was new yesterday. Yeah. Now it's not anymore. Like other drivers, as Teague prepared his car for Daytona, he shielded the front end with tape to protect the finish, knowing the repair costs for any damage would come out of his pocket. Then he hit the gas, baby.
Oh, baby.
As the 1951 Daytona race wound down, Tim Flock held a late lead and victory appeared imminent, or so it seemed to his pit crew. The mechanics started celebrating laps before the checkered flag flew. With their lips wet from drink, ew, Flock made an unexpected pit stop for fuel. His team stumbled to get him the gas, giving Teague first place. He cruised through the remaining laps to victory and his share of the $6,225 purse.
Damn.
I love that his pit crew was too hammered to put gas in his car. Like, it's a different time, man.
All that moonshine.
The tank.
The put tank.
Let's fill up our tanks, bros.
No. That's like $77,000, that prize.
Oh, damn. That's pretty good.
Wow.
It's pretty good.
And he borrowed the car.
I know, too. I love it. Like, that's the other part where it's like, again, different time. I know you're a caller. Can you just let me borrow the car for a NASCAR race?
I'm going to put tape on the front.
Yep. No, that was his rule. Only if you put tape on the front. Oh. Fine.
And it better have give or take a few miles on it.
Following the win at Daytona, Hudson's public relations department received a call alerting them of the victory, but it nearly fell on deaf ears. Tom Rhodes, then director of PR, responded with a simple, "That's nice," before hanging up the phone. He later claimed, "We don't build cars, we build automobiles.
We don't build race cars."
Oh, we don't build... Okay, I was like, that's...
The same thing.
he later claimed... Quote,
Were those not synonyms in 1951?
I was like, what?
We don't build cars, we build horseless carriages.
We don't build race cars. Okay, we got it. Keep that in. So that whole thing about not building race cars is about to change. Thanks to Marcel Teague and his pals Smokey, the best damn race car mechanic eunuch, and a self-taught wheelman named Herb Thomas. Teague made his way to Detroit and showed up at the Hudson HQ unannounced, requesting a meeting with Hudson leaders. Given his successes, they welcomed him with open arms. His pit stop included a tour of the plant, during which he made an astonishing request to be supplied with a car, parts, and factory technical support for the rest of the 1951 NASCAR season.
To which Hudson replied, "Only if you put tape on the front."
Surprisingly, though, by the time he left, he had been given the nod. Factory NASCAR racing was born.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Teague quickly found success, winning 5 of the 15 NASCAR Grand National races he entered in 1951. Having billed the Hornet as fabulous, Teague's brother adorned the race car with the now famous lettering scheme, the fabulous Hudson Hornet. Mm-hmm. By August of 51, the Detroit suits and ties were so pleased with his efforts, they decided to host an additional car in the second running of the prestigious Southern 500 in August of 1951. They left it to Teague to determine who would drive the second factory-sponsored Hudson. He set his sights on backy farmer Herb Thomas. Tobacco.
Yeah. Backy. It's also, it's the first manufacturer-sponsored NASCAR. Now it's the first manufacturer-sponsored NASCAR team.
Yeah, dude. That's awesome.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and all he did was like say, "Give me more. Give me some cars. How about that?"
Well, he's able to back it up, man.
Here's my pitch. Give me cars. I'll put tape on them. I got a tobacco farmer that wants to drive.
And that's actually why today now all NASCAR cars are wrapped.
Because of
the tape.
Oh.
It has nothing to do with that.
That's why 3M is so big right now. Born April 6th, 1923 to a poor farming family in Olivia, North Carolina, Herb grew up working with his hands, doing his best to make ends meet. His experience behind the wheel came mostly from tractors and then timber trucks, delivering lumber to a military base in his home state during World War II.
Oh, yeah, from before.
You remember?
Yeah.
Remember? A hardworking fellow dedicated to providing for his family, Thomas didn't find much time for extracurriculars. That is, until he attended his first car race at Greensboro, North Carolina in 1947. Thomas enjoyed the action so much, he later borrowed his father's car.
As
without
was the custom of the time.
Yeah, just borrow and apologize later. So he borrowed his father's car without asking to try out racing himself. And wouldn't you know it, he came home with $25 in winnings and handed it to his father, confessing to his misdeed. However, he proved to himself he was a dandy behind the wheel and fell in love with the thrill.
That kid's a dandy behind the wheel and he falls in love with the thrill. Oh, trash can on the table.
Thomas would spend his weekends refining his skill running modifieds at area ovals. It became apparent early in his racing adventures that if he took the sport seriously, he could win his way out of poverty. His mindset proved fruitful. Unlike his contemporaries, Thomas wasn't much for the drink.
Or
the girls,
his pit crews.
Didn't like pit crews?
No, they were much for the drink.
Oh,
the
they drink crews. More than enough for him. Yeah. So Thomas wasn't much for the drink, the girls, or other late night shenanigans known to be favored by fellow drivers, mechanics, and promoters. To him, racing was business. That mentality only grew stronger after making his NASCAR debut at Charlotte on June 19th, 1949, the very first strictly stock race of the series. Renamed the Grand National Division, he took home his first checkers at Martinville Speedway, driving a privately owned Plymouth the next year. By the 1951 season, Thomas had become a serious threat on the course, towing his Plymouth all across the South to race anywhere he could. As that season progressed, he found himself near the top of the points, having managed a dozen top tens and one win leading up to the prestigious Southern 500 to be held at Darlington Speedway on September 3rd. His skill and position made him a primary target for Teague, who was looking to fill the driver's seat of the second Factory Hudson in the 500-mile event, the 24th of 41 races that would be held that year. That's a lot of races. That's like most weekends. 41. The Southern 500 wasn't just about speed, though, but stamina, as 27 of that season's events were only 100 miles, with the second longest race being 250. With a total purse worth more than five times that of most other races, going all in on Darlington was a must. Thomas took Teague up on his offer and traded his Mopar for a Hornet.
Dang near trade my Mopar for a Hornet, I did.
Dang near. Came off turnpike, almost traded my
Yeah, this Mopar is crazy, man. Hornet. Like, I'm just thinking how there's this guy. I just looked up Olivia, North Carolina, where this guy's from. It's not a city. It's like an unincorporated area. Mm-hmm. As of 2000, according to Wikipedia, there's a population of like 400 people. This guy's out from out in the sticks, you know, driving trucks,
growing back,
trying to make it. And like, there's a, like, you couldn't drive your way out of poverty today, you know?
Like, the problem is the barrier to entry.
Yeah. Barrier to entry is very high. And, I mean, yeah, so many of those roles are already filled. I mean, dude, you look at like NASCAR or like any other like high level racing series, and it's like, You know, we do this show and read names and we're like, I recognize that name. Is he really? And then like you look and you're like, oh, the kid, his great grandson is now in NASCAR or something like that, you know?
Is there a Teague in NASCAR now?
I don't think so, but it's just, you know, so many of those spots are pretty much like spoken for already. It's like, oh, if I'm a big name in racing already,
well, it's 'cause when you start, open
You
know, it's literally grandfathered in.
So yeah, it's just interesting.
I think there is, I think as much as racing has been gentrified since this era, I think there is a little bit of a leveling with sim racing.
Yeah. I mean, we're still kind of waiting for those, for that to come to fruition.
I think you have guys in Xfinity, who came from sim. You know, certainly everybody's had to, you have to do the circuit and work your way up.
Yeah. But well, you need Xfinity to run your
sim.
I just saw a headline. There's like a iRacing affiliated driver who I think was at first a sim driver, and now they're going into F2 next season, which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
So that's Max Esterson. Thank you. Yeah, Max Esterson. That's pretty neat. So I don't know. I guess we'll start to see that hopefully more. I don't know. Because, yeah, I'm tired of like, I mean, look.
Look, we all love Lance Stroll, right?
I'd also say, though, like, we're talking about 1951. Like, yeah, and if you look at even Olympic teams, it's like, well, you can swim. So let's send you to the Olympics.
Totally.
He jumped 9 feet in the long jump.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Anyway, to ensure Thomas's Hudson was ready for the long-distance run, Teague paired him with his own crew chief, Smokey Unick. We actually did a series on Smokey Unick back way early in the History of Past Gas, episodes 7 and 8. Super interesting guy. But for the purposes of our tale, we need to recall a bit about Smokey and who he was. Daniel Pierce described Unick as, quote, a fast-talking, profane, hard-drinking, carousing mechanical genius in his book, Real NASCAR. And I think that sums him up well. But to take it a step further, he had a reputation for bending the rules, or in layman's terms, cheating, though he described his efforts more as reading between the lines. In many cases, Unick would pull a stunt that wasn't in the rulebook, only to find his tactics outlawed soon after. I mean, this guy was super famous for that.
Yeah. He'd also, was just to his genius, would tell you he was doing something illegal, so you'd stop it.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the thing he was doing, you know? And so he'd do the other thing would get through.
Yeah.
So you know, he was pretty brilliant. And I also think he
bait and switch.
Yep. In Daytona, he's not in the NASCAR. He's not in the Motorsports Hall of Fame.
He's like the Pete Rose.
He should be, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. But he didn't bat. I mean, he didn't bat on his own sport.
This guy. I'm. Did Smokey have the gold smuggling plane?
No.
Yeah.
That wasn't Smokey.
That wasn't Smokey?
I forget who that was.
I thought I knew what carousing meant. It's a very specific word. Mm-hmm. This is the definition of carousing. The activity of drinking alcohol and enjoying oneself with others in a noisily, lively way.
Okay.
Smokey Eunuch.
Never mind. That's exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah.
I thought it was drinking by yourself, but it's oneself. Never mind.
There was a lot of drug smuggling racers.
NASCAR.
IndyCar.
Yeah, IndyCar. The Whittington brothers. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that had the plane.
Smokey Eunuch worked in gold mining in Ecuador for 30 years after his racing career.
What?
Yeah, he was also
How
an oil
old was
bearer.
He when he was racing?
That's right. I knew it. So suppose it wasn't gold smuggling, but he was a smuggler because after the war, I think he went over to China or that area and would fly over the Himalayas and smuggle stuff.
Huh.
Anyway.
En route to his legitimate gold business.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dude, this guy's crazy, man. Okay, anyway, Smokey. I'm glad Smokey's in the story. Yeah. He's a character. So, with his winning reputation on the line as the owner of Smokey's Best Damn Garage in Town near Daytona Beach, Eunuch was none too pleased with Teague's choice of driver. That was until he watched Thomas run practice laps at Darlington. Quote.
I'll do it. That son of a bitch could haul flat ass. Flat ass.
Haul flat. That guy's hauling flat ass. I mean,
he's like the miner that like
You're gonna make him a gold prospector.
Yeah, boy.
Do it, Joe.
That son of a bitch could haul flat ass. That son of a bitch could flat haul ass. And you could see he was in total control.
Eunuch quipped about Thomas. Despite Eunuch's back pocket method, you can haul flat ass. Despite Eunuch's back pocket methodology, he was undoubtedly an extremely talented mechanic. Matched with Thomas's hard driving style, they proved to be quite a team. Smokey and Herb aced the Southern 500 and snagged the $8,800 first place prize. That's close to 110 grand today. Pretty good for a day's work. After four more first places in the fabulous Hudson Hornet in 1951, Thomas closed the points gap and won his first Grand National Championship. Not bad for someone who Eunuch once referred to as a dirt poor Bush Hill.
Sounds like they got alarmed. That's,
yeah.
I would love to be insulted by Smokey Eunuch.
Yeah.
The Hudson folks up in Detroit were stoked, and by the end of the 1951 model year, the company had built 131,915 cars, including 43,666 sick Hornets. Year after year, production had grown by some 10,000 units. Surely, the success of the racetrack must have something to do with this growth, right? That was the consensus, and Team Hudson doubled down. Their ads soon focused on the speed of the championship-winning car, asking consumers to, quote, come try the power for yourself.
Heading into 1952, Hudson added new drivers to its lineup. At one point or another, that included Dick Rathman, Tim Flock, his brother Fonty Flock, Lou Figaro, and Rebel Mundy, with Herb Thomas still leading the pack. Those are awesome names.
Half these names sound like characters from Cats.
Cats.
I call myself Fonty Flock, and that's Rebel Mundy.
Meow, meow, lick my tummy.
Rebel Mundy.
Rebel Mundy, played by Rebel Wilson. Okay, go ahead. In the pale moonlight, or what, I don't know.
Oh, you didn't eat your Abba Zabba.
I didn't finish my Abba Zabba.
All alone in the moonlight.
Half of an eighth of an Abba Zabba was enough.
Marshall Teague started the season with Hudson too, but his time would be cut short. To remain competitive, Hudson engineers and Eunuch developed a variety of racing parts for the Hornet catalog, only available on special order and designated for police cars and taxis. That's a sick loophole.
Mm-hmm.
This limited... Why do taxis need to be super fast?
You answer your own question, buddy. If you can make it to the LAX Terminal 1 in 20 minutes, I'll give you $50.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And then he like flips up a fake gauge thing. This just reminds me of like the car. Doesn't he get like a loaner in The Mask? And it's like an old taxi cab.
I'm telling you, it looks like a taxi. It looks like you're eating a taxi.
Yeah. Tastes like it too. This limited expensive production, but made them eligible for racing under strictly stock rules that dictated all parts on a car had to be available to the public.
There you go.
That's a good loophole. Damn. Yeah. That's a smoky eunuch loophole.
And that's, eunuch going up the chain like, hey, let's make these parts.
Listen here, you son of a bitch.
Listen here.
Deemed severe usage, these thinly veiled racing components began to show up in 1952, offering the first evidence of Hudson's direct involvement in the sport outside of providing cars and funding. I love that phrasing, too.
Severe usage.
You should make a sticker with that or a patch.
Severe usage.
Severe usage parts included upgraded axles, shocks, and brakes, though the biggest addition for 52 came in the twin H-power carburetor setup.
Mm.
The upgrade included 2 1-barrel Carter carbs and cast iron intake and exhaust manifolds. Refinements of the unit bumped the H-145 straight 6 to 170 horsepower, giving the Hornet a top speed of 107 miles per hour.
Dang.
This was just the beginning of Hudson's deep involvement in producing factory racing parts.
This still goes on today. This still goes on today, though, where it's you can get the shit version of a car.
Yeah.
And because the company makes these other, it's bolt on, go get them from a junkyard, I think that's great that Hudson, doing that.
It's cool. Yeah.
It seems like maybe the first type of that.
Yeah.
Production.
Yeah. Limited because they were, one, a lot of people who were just buying cars weren't interested in it. So they didn't have to do it to a special model, which is brilliant. And then the fact that, the people who would be interested, it would go get them.
And then nowadays we have like the Demon Crate.
Mm-hmm.
Or, that's crazy that was like 7 years ago.
Right.
I still think about that was like one of the first things that I experienced when I first started working at Donut. Mm-hmm. I think we got the Demon pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
And the crate that you buy for $1 or something like that.
Yep.
And it's back seats out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got an ECU
flash tune.
Piggyback. Yeah.
The 1952 season kicked off with Teague and Thomas finishing 1-2 at Daytona.
Nice.
However, by the 6th race of the season, Teague had a falling out with NASCAR boss Bill France over competing in another stock series, the AAA. Teague left NASCAR for good, winning the AAA championship in his Hudson in 1952 and 54. With Teague's departure, Herb Thomas became the primary driver for Hudson in the Elite Series. In 1952, Thomas would take second in the points to Tim Flock, who also piloted a Hudson.
Sorry, I'm just Tim Flock and then his brother.
Mundy?
No. Fundy? Fonty.
Fonty.
Fonty Flock. He's like, yeah, my brother's a cat. And he sings at night. He's got his own name that he calls himself.
You know you're getting, like, sharing a car with Fonty Flock when you get in and all the seats are, like, ripped up.
Memory.
Lord. That year, Hornets won 22 of 34 NASCAR Grand National races.
Damn.
The success continued in 53 with Herb Thomas retaking the points crown, becoming NASCAR's first 2-time champion.
Damn, okay. As Thomas set his sights on a third trophy, Hudson's future began to unravel. With ads touting the Hornet as the national stock car champion, the company faced slumping sales. To combat this, $15 million went to developing a new compact car, the Jet. Thanks to Hudson's involvement with NASCAR, both Bill France and Tim Flock participated in its launch party for the 1953 model, yet the radical costs of this new car put the company in a dire position, and the rest of the Hudson lineup suffered in terms of its outdated looks. In the end, the Jet didn't have the desired impact that year, selling just 21,000 units.
It's cute, though.
Total Hudson production fell to 66,143 cars for the 1953 model year, half that of 2 years prior. With its neck under the guillotine, Hudson pulled out all the stops for the 1954 season. The biggest achievement to date came in the form of the severe usage,
Severe usage 7X
version of the H145, a racing engine designed to be driven with your foot through the floor, as it ran best at 4,000 RPM. What made the 7X so fantastic? Under Unix guidance, it received larger valves, a high compression head, a hot cam, and a dual exhaust manifold. These options pushed horsepower to as much as 210 and resulted in high torque at low RPM.
That's really good for the time.
This helped the Hornet outrun more powerful V8s from Ford, Oldsmobile, and Buick, but it proved to be too little too late.
I like that they see that their business is just like tanking and they're like, let's just keep doing racing. I don't know. It's really expensive, but let's just keep doing it.
I mean, dude, they spent
for Dodge 7 years ago.
Yeah.
They spent $15 million in 53. I mean, that's got to be billions, right?
Yeah.
$10 million in 53 is $118 million today. So 50% more of that. So they're putting like, they're spending $175 million on this new car. Jet, it flops because frankly I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, it's cute, but like it's a two-door compact model.
It doesn't look like anything new. It's pretty boxy, like round.
It doesn't look new.
It looks cute, that's all I care about. The Hornet was sleek.
Cool.
Yeah,
this is not what I'm looking for.
It looks like Ron's car from Harry Potter.
It looks an Anglica.
Yeah, it does.
It does. Yeah, that's a great comparison.
Speaking of movie cars,
there's no way this was going to be successful. That's unfortunate. So, yeah, might as well go out racing.
Yeah, go out in a blaze of glory. With mounting financial troubles, Hudson's board of directors approved a plan to merge with Nash Kelvinator in early 1954 to form American Motors Corporation, just before the racing season got underway.
Side note, Roy D. Chapman Sr., who was one of the co-founders of Hudson.
Yeah.
Son worked for the company and was the first to run AMC. Roy D. Chapman Jr. ran AMC.
I was thinking of Mitt Romney's dad was Rambler.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. George Romney. He was.
Have you heard him talk? That makes sense.
He rambles.
Yeah.
That guy rambles. Let me tell you. What is Nash, right?
Looking.
Are you thinking of Steve Nash from the NBA?
Automobile.
My favorite Canadian NBA player. Yeah. Nash Kelvinator.
Nice, dude.
Okay.
And that's this company.
Yeah. I knew it.
Dude.
People in the comments always say, Joe and Nolan, you guys just run your mouth and it's all BS. You have a computer. Look it up. And sometimes we're right, you know?
Yeah, man. So we got Smokey Unick involved. We got George Romney.
Yeah.
Nice.
And that brings us to the 2006 Salt Lake City Olympics. Okay. The news of this new merger didn't stop Hudson nor Thomas from giving it their all, as the pair won the season opener at Palm Beach Raceway in February. With the merger becoming official on May 1st, 1954, the writing was on the wall. But Thomas's foot was still through the floor, baby. You know what I'm talking about, baby. I'm in a like 2-hour sleep mode right now. In the last race of the year, on October 10th, 1954, Herb Thomas drove his number 92 Hornet to fourth place at the Mid-South 250. That year, he captured 12 wins, but fell to second in the points to Lee Petty, who claimed his first NASCAR championship. Just 20 days later, on October 30th, 1954, the Detroit Hudson plant shuttered and production moved to Nash's Kenosha line, Kenosha being 20 minutes south of Milwaukee, my place of birth. Also where Gavin Lux is from the Dodgers. Hudson's dominant racing days were over. In total, the Hornet won 78 of the 149 NASCAR Grand National races between 1951 and 1954, earning titles in 51, 52, and 53, as well as a second place finish in 54. The car also won AAA stock car titles in 52, 53, and 54. For Hudson, racing could not save it. But their efforts opened the door for others, specifically the big three, to find value in factory racing. While nearly every major American automaker gave NASCAR a go at one point, today the field has narrowed to Chevrolet, Toyota, and Ford. The final car to bear the Hudson badge drove off into the sunset on June 25th, 1957, as AMC turned focus to its Rambler and Metropolitan marks. Ironically, Roy D. Chapin Jr., the son of the Hudson co-founder, joined AMC in 1954 and later served as CEO. He proved instrumental in acquiring Kaiser Jeep for American Motors, with the Jeep nameplate being the last surviving vehicle brand of the AMC era. While the great ride for Hudson ended with the closure of the 54 NASCAR season, Teague, Unick, and Thomas all found ways to keep going fast.
Marshall Teague never returned to NASCAR, winning 7 of the 23 races he entered between 1949 and 1952. He continued to race in the AAA series through 1958, winning championships in his Hudson in 52 and 54. He also competed in three Indy 500s. He met an untimely end on February 11, 1959, while attempting to break the closed-circuit speed record at the brand-new Daytona International Speedway. Driving the Sumar Special, a reconfigured Indy car on a Curtis Craft chassis with a 270-cubic-inch Offenhauser engine, Teague reached a speed of around 140 miles an hour when the car spun and flipped. He was ejected during the accident and died instantly of his injuries. He was 37 years old.
Oh, man.
Smokey Unick would continue his racing career as a crew chief, owner, and car designer and engineer. He'd also author multiple books and claim many patents related to automotive and racetrack engineering. In 2000, he was inducted into the Motorsports Hall of Fame of America. The next year, he passed away at age 77 due to leukemia. Herb Thomas moved to GM Products for the 1955 NASCAR season, but a wreck took him out of competition for 3 months. He returned in time to win his third Southern 500 in his Motoramic Chevrolet and claimed fifth in points that year. In 1956, Herb started the season as an owner driver and earned wins for a few other owners, including one last grip for Unick. With a grip on the points, a surprise race was organized in Shelby, North Carolina late in the season by team owner Carl Kiekhafer. It suggested he put the event together to give his driver Buck Baker a chance to close the gap. On lap 109 of 200, Baker's teammate Speedy Thompson tapped Herb Thomas, causing Herb's car to spin and roll before being hit by several other drivers. Thomas was transported to the hospital in a coma. Speculation soon arose that Kiekhafer had ordered his driver to trigger the wreck to ensure Baker could improve his standing. While Baker claimed he wouldn't race if Herb Thomas wasn't on the track, he did head back to the Oval and ultimately won the year's championship.
I mean,
I know I said it.
I kind of just like said it to say it, though.
Thomas attempted to return, but two starts in 1957 and one in 1962 proved fruitless. He walked away from NASCAR with 48 career victories and 228 starts, resulting in a 21.05 win percentage, the best of any driver to date with at least 100 career starts. Richard Petty later described Herb as, quote, one of the best, if not the very best drivers that's ever come through NASCAR. There's no telling what he may have accomplished on the track if he wasn't forced into an early retirement. After hanging up his goggles following the 1962 entry, Herb Thomas returned to his roots and started a trucking company and sawmill. He earned a place in the International Motorsports Hall of Fame in 1994 and was posthumously inducted into the NASCAR Hall of Fame in 2013 and the Motorsports Hall of Fame of America in 2017. Thomas passed away at age 77 in 2000. Herb Thomas's legacy is forever etched into pop culture thanks to a little Hollywood tale called Cars. His story, his victories and defeats, including his career-ending crash, all highly influenced the character Doc Hudson in the movie franchise, originally voiced by fellow race car driver Paul Newman. Hudson, of course, referring to the Hudson Hornet. Smokey Unick is also enshrined in animated lore as Smokey in Cars 3. The earliest surviving championship-winning NASCAR vehicle is a 1952 Fabulous Hudson Hornet raced by Thomas. It is now displayed at the Ypsilanti Automotive Heritage Museum, which is housed in a former Hudson dealership in Ypsilanti, Michigan. The Hornet is exhibited as an artifact of the pioneering days of NASCAR and the birth of factory-sponsored racing on American ovals. But it also serves as a reminder that winning on Sunday doesn't always translate to selling on Monday. If it did, we might all be driving Hudson Hornets today. Dang.
Dang, we could all be driving Hudson Hornets today.
Old cars that make 140 horsepower.
I misspoke. I said Smokey isn't in the Motorsports Hall of Fame. He is. He's not in the NASCAR.
The NASCAR Hall of Fame.
Because of all the cheating?
NASCAR.
No, just he never got along. He was he was the black sheep.
He didn't play the politics?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He's a racer, not a freaking politician.
I'm a driver. I'm a winner. Things are going to change. I can feel it.
Dude, the Hudson Hornet's sick. That's a cool looking
car. It really
car.
Is. And talk about liveries.
Yeah. It's hard to beat that one.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to beat it. All right, we got some listener mail this week.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
Joe,
yeah.
Joe, take it away as I eat this Abba Zabba. Right,
hey, guys, my name is Mike. I'm from upstate New York. I've been listening to your show for the past few years.
It's not upstate.
I'm from upstate New York. Is that better?
It's perfect.
Okay.
I love the
really draw it out.
Buffalo.
I love buffalo wings. I've been listening to your show for the last few years at work to help the day go faster. I work at the post office fixing mail trucks and thought it might be interesting to hear a show about the delivery vehicles used by the post office over the years. Everything from the Jeeps in the 50s to the three-wheeled Mailster to the current LLV.
Mm.
There's actually even a more current LLV than that. It's a GD. There's four letters in it. Keep up the great work on the podcast and the YouTube videos, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
I'm just chewing away at this Abba Zabba here.
Yeah, maybe not good timing on that since we got
a great episode for you coming next week.
Yeah.
That's why I put it in there. Yeah. Audrey is on top of the ball putting this letter in here. You're going to be hearing all about the post office next week, sir.
Nolan's talking like a 80s baseball manager. You want a cup to spit in?
You know, we just can't figure out this Lasorda guy. Like he's really good up on the mound. You know, to win games, you got to beat the other team, and he's making it hard to beat him. So we'll be back out there. I would love to be a manager, dude. Just a big old just pocket of seeds or chaw or something.
Yeah. Dude, Aaron Boone, did you watch any of the World Series?
Yeah.
Aaron Boone on the Yankees, like last game, you know, they're down 3-1 or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's just like shoveling him in, just like dissociating. And it's like stuff is happening and it's just like all these seeds just keep popping out of his mouth and you can just tell he's like, oh,
So if you'd like to send us an email, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com. Thank you for your email, Mike. Baseball is awesome. Post office is coming soon. Bart, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you guys for having me. It's always fun.
Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joji Weber.
Send us snacks for the Road and Snack segment, please. We want Australian people. Send us some weird
something
Australian
we've never
thing.
Heard of.
Yeah.
Send us Canadian poutine or whatever. We'll try to review it if it's not gross.
Send us poutine.
I would love if fries and gravy came in the mail.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love it.
Send your snacks to P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306. We'll see you next week.
Yes, we will.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.